Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today our guest is Lieutenant General Retired Dan Carbler, who was the commander of U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, and, you know, he's had a lot of other jobs. He is the, you know, if you want to talk about air defense, which is kind of important right now with a little dust up going on in the Middle East. There's no better person to talk to about this topic and about, you know, trying to shoot down Iranian drones and other missiles that they're shooting at folks. So why not have the best? Well, that's what we decided to do. General Carbler, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
You bet, Adam. It's my pleasure to be here. Looking forward to having a great conversation about all things air and missile defense, strategic deterrence, nuclear operations. We can go as far afield as you want.
Yeah, and you were the chief of staff at STRATCOM too. So that's, you know, it's funny. It's now, before, I know we have a specific topic, but in my experience in the time I've worked with STRATCOM and been on staff, it's always the chief of staff is always an Army two-star. What's the rationale for that? Because I don't know, like, when did that start and what made it, you know, what made it start like that? Can you help me out with that?
Yeah, I mean, when you go back in the history, Army two-star, and many, many times it was an Army air missile defender. Mm-hmm. And I think that the STRATCOM commander always liked having that Army air missile defense expertise there. Because if you remember, part of STRATCOM in their unified command plan, STRATCOM owned missile defense. And so to have a general officer with that missile defense expertise to help advise the STRATCOM commander on the missile defense posture, what was going on in the Army's missile defense world, as well as the joint community with respect to missile defense, was really important. And when you look at, you know, kind of classic deterrence, you know, the elements, right? Impose unacceptable cost, that's all the nuclear operations. Deny the adversary benefit, which is now you look at the missile defense piece and what we do for missile defense, that's denying them the benefit. And then the credible messaging. So I think we provided one part of that, you know, kind of the classic element of deterrence as far as denying the adversary the benefit of their attacks.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. That's a good rationale for having the Army involved. And, you know, there's some of the best, some of the best strike advisors have been, you know, like FA-52s and missile defense guys. So, you know, the Army's got an important role at STRATCOM.
Yeah, and speaking of which, so it's really good. So John Widener right now, Major General John Widener is the chief of staff there, an FA-52. I think probably the first time we've had a two-star FA-52 there. And John and I worked together when I was the chief and John was a colonel there at STRATCOM. And talk about an invaluable resource is having a guy who's an Army two-star who's so well-versed in all aspects of nuclear operations and nuclear policy.
I think he was the first FA-52 general officer writ large, I think, but certainly the first two-star. I know that for sure too. So he is a great guy. Okay. So I've taken us down a rabbit trail, but we wanted to talk space or air and missile defense for, you know, related to what's going on in Iran and just their seeming, what seems to be at least for now, an endless supply of, you know, drones that can attack Israel, Saudi Arabia, you know, the entire region and, you know, some other missile capabilities. So talk to us for many of our, in our audience, this is not their area of expertise. So can you give us sort of, you know, a foundational understanding of air and missile defense and then walk us through kind of where we are, what we have, you know, can we defend against, how long can we defend against the Iranians? What capabilities can we or can we not defend against? Help us understand this important topic.
Sure, Adam. I'll kind of start, if I can, I'll start at the strategic level and then just kind of work our way down down to the more tactical level. So strategic level, air and missile defense, ground-based mid-course defense. Those are the interceptors we have up at Fort Greely, Alaska, as well as some that are at Vandenberg Space Force Base. That's to defend against any ICBM attacks from North Korea or potentially Iran. You know, really just those attacks. We rely on our strategic deterrent to deter Russia or Chinese ICBM attacks. And those systems, that ground-based mid-course defense system, is manned by Alaska National Guard soldiers, as well as soldiers down in Colorado, where kind of the command and control is at, and then some soldiers who are out at Vandenberg Space Force Base. 24/7, 365, those folks are on console, prepared to defend North America against any, again, ICBM attacks from North Korea or Iran, potentially. If you saw the movie House of Dynamite, Fort Greely was featured pretty prominently in that movie as well. And we can certainly talk about that later on if we want to. So kind of taking down to the next level, helping that homeland defense are some strategic radars that we have. Japan, Middle East, UCOM. We've got the Tippy 2 radars in the forward base mode. A lot of times we'll associate those radars with the THAAD missile system, and they're very similar. But these are standalone radars that allow us to do regional, you know, support regional missile defense. They also contribute to homeland defense, and they can do some space surveillance as well. We made the decision a few years ago, and as a Space and Missile Defense Command commander, to pull the missile defense mission out from underneath STRATCOM's responsibility and put it under the SPACECOM's responsibility. And we did that so the SPACECOM commander could really have ownership and control of those radars, those strategic radars, to use them for any kind of space surveillance missions that he might need. And so we did that, and it worked out pretty well. So taking now a step down, so from the ICBM defense to those strategic radars in the forward base mode. Now you have the THAAD weapon system. You see a lot of the news about THAAD right now, obviously over in the Middle East. And THAAD is, you know, a level above Patriot in terms of the range and altitude and threat inventory that the THAAD missile can intercept. And THAAD is, you know, it's been doing yeoman's work right now over in the Middle East as part of the layered defense. You know, combine it with the Aegis BMD, Israeli Aero, and then at the next level down, our PAC-3 MSE missile defense capabilities. It provides, again, that layering capability comes in there. So then you have the PAC-3 MSE capability, really for the shorter, you know, shorter engagements, not quite at the same range that the THAAD missile takes out, and the THAAD radar can take out the interceptors at, and then bring it down one level even below that, and that's some of our short range counter UAS capabilities, which we're seeing employed. We wish we had more of them, because you don't want to spend Patriot missiles, you know, shooting down Shahad drones. You've seen a lot of that discussion going on. We have a finite number of interceptors, but we have some counter UAS capabilities. To the Army's credit, it recognized this challenge that we had, that we did not have counter UAS capabilities. Back in the early 2000s, the Army made a decision to get rid of all of its divisional short-range air defense battalions. That was 9 battalions of short-range air defense, 9 battalions of Avengers and Stingers, and the weapon systems that are, I mean, they're perfect for being able to defend against the drones. The Army didn't see the threat the same way the air defense community did. The Army had other bills to pay, so the air defense divisional force structure became the bill payer for that. And we've seen Avenger with some success over in Ukraine. We gave the Ukrainians some Avenger weapon systems, and we've seen that the Avengers were able to take out Shahad. I would love right now to have had 9 battalions worth of Avenger weapon systems over in the Middle East right now to help counter the drone threats that are coming in there. I mean, you think about it, 1 Avenger has 8 Stinger missiles on it. In the heyday, in the 2000s, we had over 1,000 Avenger weapon systems. That would be significant capabilities that we could have to counter the drones. So that's kind of walking it all the way down from the strategic all the way down to very tactical air missile defense level capabilities.
So in terms of the capabilities the United States has, I mean, we have, you know, I think, what is it up at Fort Greely? It's like 44 missiles. So it's small numbers. And when it comes to, you know, THAAD and Patriot and, you know, our short range capabilities, I mean, can we stay actively engaged defending against the, I mean, the Shahed drones are, you know, the, what are they, $10,000 to $50,000 each. They're relatively inexpensive, and it's, you know, they've got thousands of them. Can we stay actively engaged defending, or, you know, are we going to go Winchester pretty quick?
So that's a great question. I'm thinking, you know, as I look at what's transpired here in the last 10 days, the number of Iranian missiles, not a surprise. We knew that they had the largest inventory of ballistic missiles in the Middle East. So we knew that they had deep magazines. What we hope is that our attack operations, which is part of integrated air missile defense, kind of the operational one of the operational imperatives, get the attack ops out there and defeat the launchers, defeat the missiles, defeat the storage areas, the garrisons, the hide sites, the command and control, so that less, you know, they say, you know, take the archer out, you know, before the arrow can get launched. I kind of say it's a bow. The archer might be the dude or the dudette. The bow is the launcher itself. And then the arrow is what gets shot at us. So let's take the bow out. You know, unfortunately, the first 4 or 5 days while we're trying to establish air superiority, air supremacy over Iranian airspace, you've got to be prepared to take that 4 or 5 days worth of barrage. And then, and as our Air Force and the Navy are beating back their integrated air, the Iranian air defenses, they're able to get deeper in, prosecute all those targets. The Iranians no longer can just kind of with impunity, you know, set up, shoot and scoot and come back in. Now, as soon as they come out and expose themselves, they're going to get targeted fairly rapidly, whether that be air to surface or surface to surface capabilities. So a long way of going to say, we want to be able to hold out with the number of interceptors for 4 to 5 days, be able to defend against those barrages, allow our Air Force and TAC ops then to really thin it all out, and then be able to sustain lower volumes of fire that the Iranians might be able to muster to come back at us. And then on top of that too, and you know, you saw the president last week meet with the CEOs of the big defense industries, and you know, you kind of tip your hat to them a little bit. They do have the capacity. They have the ability to ramp up the capacity. It's just a matter of, you know, getting the right funding, and, you know, hopefully Congress gives an emergency supplemental or munition supplemental or something that that will, you know, help industry just to continue to churn out our interceptors that we need. And I might add, not just the interceptors in our capability, but let's not be naive. All those attacks that have come in there, you saw one of the soldiers, the 7 soldiers that died was part of 1st Space Brigade. You know, we've had equipment damage too that's going to have to be, if can't be repaired, it's got to be replaced. And again, those primes out there are postured to be able to do that.
Yeah. That was the other thing I was going to ask you is, you know, with the, you know, we've been supporting the Ukrainians for, I guess, what, 4 years now? And, you know, we now have this fight. I guess my question is, can we just continue to, you know, to support these kinds of fights? Because it doesn't seem, from what I've read, we're not replacing these capabilities at the speed that we're using them up. And, you know, like you said, the president, he understands the problem. But are we actually doing something about the problem? I've heard that some of the lines, you know, that the lines are, they'd have to be reconstituted for some of the manufacturers just because the people are gone. They shut the lines down completely. And so, you know, restarting a line to produce a, you know, a weapon, it's not that quick and easy. Where actually are we in terms of making this happen and sort of, you know, rebuilding the arsenal?
Yeah, I'm maybe a little bit more optimistic just because some of those lines, you know, foreign military sales have kept those lines warm and going. You know, if you look at the Patriot weapon system, a lot of countries have got Patriot. Countries are using PAC-3 MSE. Countries have also procured the THAAD weapon system and THAAD missiles. And so it hasn't come to a standstill. We're continuing, those lines are continuing to go. Now, to be able to scale up now is really going to become the question. And yeah, some of those supply chain difficulties and some of those sub vendors to make sure that we're covered down and some of those maybe more exquisite components that help make up the interceptors or part of the weapon system, those will be important. But again, this is not coming from a cold start now, that we have continued to procure and build the interceptors and the weapon systems. And so I think part of the president's message to the CEOs was, hey, I want more and I want it now. And probably the message back is, well, somebody needs to stroke the checks. Yeah. I mean, appropriations, munitions, emergency appropriations, or something there to be able to help us out. It's one thing to state policy. It's another thing to, you know, policy doesn't, you know,
pay the bills.
No, exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. So it's that time.
The other thing too, Adam, sorry. The other thing too is our allies are out there fighting right alongside with us. So the allies providing their capabilities and, you know, they're going to have their own sustainment and replenishment requirements too. So it only really behooves the defense industrial base to ramp up production. And they all got the message 2 months ago when President Trump kind of had the naughty list. They all got the message.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's a good thing you mentioned that. Because that was hopefully somewhat motivation to sort of get things going. Okay, so it's that time of show where we got to take a quick break. So we'll do that, and then when we come back, I want to sort of have a two-part question. The first thing is, how do you see the Iran conflict playing out in terms of, you know, are the Shahads going to sort of go by the way? Are we getting close to the end of capability for Iran to attack the UAE and Saudi and, you know, other regional states? And then the second part is I want to shift to Golden Dome and get your take on that. So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Lieutenant General retired Dan Carbler, who career air and missile defender, knows it, commanded it, you know, who better to talk to. So I posed a question before the break about sort of the future of Iran and, you know, how is this going to play itself out? What's your take on that?
I wish I had a crystal ball and be able to, you know, peer into the future. You know, you've heard some very clearly defined objectives: eliminate their ability to influence the region through ballistic missiles, through their Navy, and, you know, destroy their ability to have any kind of nuclear capability. I think those are three objectives that have crystallized really over the last 10 days. Then you heard the president say unconditional surrender. I think that's a pretty heavy lift.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that you can compel unconditional surrender just from the air. Unconditional surrender may require boots on the ground, and that'll be a whole nother level of discussion that the administration will have to have and debate within Congress and the American public, because I don't know, you know, save Japan in World War II, unconditional surrender, I don't know that we've had unconditional surrender by any other adversary. And the only way that we were able to compel Japan to unconditionally surrender was to drop two nuclear weapons on them. So we should always keep that in the forefront of what measures would it take? If your ends are unconditional surrender, what ways and means are you willing to take to get that unconditional surrender? And that could drag this out longer, and it could introduce other elements of combat operations that are going to go beyond the reduce their ability to shoot ballistic missiles, destroy their Navy, destroy their nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that the intensity of attacks we've seen, or, you know, we saw over the first 5 days, we're seeing that ramp down. General Kane, you know, this morning's press conference said they're seeing quite a reduction of that. We know that Iran's got pretty big stockpiles of them, but now their ability to put missiles on launchers and be able to fire them is really reduced because, like I said before, we have aircraft and surveillance and everything overhead over the Iranian airspace where we can pretty rapidly target them. So now it kind of becomes a little bit more of, you know, what's the new regime going to look like? What's going to be their focus or what's going to be their goals going forward? And will the U.S. or our Gulf partners be able to influence that at all? And then let's not forget any kind of third party acting going on with Russia or Chinese influence there too, because nature abhors a vacuum, and where there might be a little bit of a vacuum within Iran, let's not kid ourselves, Russia or China will want to be stepping in there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And this is really a test of, you know, if you look historically, the United States, you know, prior to World War I and World War II, the United States primarily engaged in punitive wars or punitive expeditions. Somebody would kill some, you know, some Americans and, you know, some far off place. Then the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps would go to that island or that country. They'd punish them, you know, with, you know, some military force and say, don't do that again, or we'll be back and in more force. And then we would leave. And if you look historically, just numerically, that's the majority of how the U.S. has used force. And then subsequently to World War II, we've not done that. This could be the first example, really sort of in recent history, where it's a punitive expedition. And, you know, we'll see if that's kind of where it stops. And then like, hey, we'll be back worse next time. And, you know, and I think the president, you know, I would be guessing that, you know, he said, rise up and take your country back. And so he's sort of given some assistance to help folks do that. But it's going to, in many respects, be incumbent on the Iranian people to do that. So we'll see if, you know, kind of how this plays out. Now, with that said, you know, the other big thing is Golden Dome. And we would be remiss if we didn't get the guy to talk about Golden Dome. So how do you see, I mean, Golden Dome to me is still amorphous. I'm not quite sure what it looks like, how big it's going to be. Is it going to just protect, you know, key sites? Is it going to protect the country? You know, what's your take on where you think it's going to go?
Yeah, so, you know, when the president put out the executive order, I thought it was a fairly comprehensive list of, I'll call them requirements, of what the president wants done with respect to Golden Dome. Everything from left of launch, which means before it even gets, you know, out of the silo, off the airstrip, you know, off the launcher, whatever, take care of it, left of launch, all the way through to protecting our assets. So I think the first thing is you have to look at the threats and the threat capabilities to the homeland and everything from ICBMs to container launch cruise missiles to, you know, Operation Spiderweb kind of drones. Let's not kid ourselves. Drones are going to be part of the threat equation going forward, whether they're, you know, out of a containerized ship that's off the coast somewhere, or whether it's bad actors who share the ideology that are here within the United States that just want to load up some explosives on a drone and go fly it into a base or fly it into, you know, shoot one of our strategic deterrence locations like Offutt or Kings Bay or Bangor or, you know, Minot, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
So we've got to be prepared to be able to defend against that. What are those threats? And then, you know, the policy decisions that will be made in terms of the defended assets. I know NORTHCOM has got its defended asset list that it's generated, you know, whether it's population centers, critical infrastructure, kind of the long-term ones or the more static ones, to much more episodic like national special security events or other areas that might not be 24/7, but we're going to have to defend them. And then we're going to have them the capabilities that provide. And because of the president's aggressive timeline, you know, now is not the time to try to invent something that will deliver in 5 years for Golden Dome. So for the platforms, in Carbler's view, in the next 24 months to meet the president's timeline, it's going to be platforms that are existing. Industry can go ahead and do all the upgrades, all the product improvement program for those different weapon systems to get them as, you know, the most capable capability. And then the operational side will deploy those out to whatever the defended assets are that the NORTHCOM commander and frankly that the president or SEC war deem, you know, from the one to end list of defended assets, deem that have to be protected. One other piece too that's worth noting, because it entails my former job as the Space and Missile Defense Command commander, is the SMDC commander, Sean Gainey, right now stood up JTF Gold. And JTF Gold is really the operational arm of Golden Dome for America, working for the NORTHCOM commander. And so, you know, the NORTHCOM commander's got a big AO. He's got a lot of responsibility, you know, southern border to, you know, any kind of environmental catastrophes or, you know, weather disasters, whatever. So being able to empower a three-star commander to take the day-to-day operations of JTF Gold is really important. So SMDC, and the other hat that the SMDC commander wears is the Joint Functional Component Command for Integrated Missile Defense, JFIC IMD. That's out in Colorado Springs, staff of about 130 people. That really became the foundation for JTF Gold. And then I know SMDC is really kind of cross-matrix, cross-SMDC headquarters too, to help flesh out the JTF Gold staff. And then what the other piece too, to kind of give some more robustness to the operational depth for JTF Gold is Sean Gainey was able to take the 32nd Army Air Missile Defense Command and put that underneath SMDC control, and the 263rd Army Air Missile Defense, the National Guard, AAMDC, that's been responsible for the National Capital Region defense for many, many years, and put that under his control. Before, they used to be underneath FORSCOM, the old, you know, now Western Hemisphere Command. And when Western Hemisphere Command stood up, General Gainey took the opportunity to kind of move those, both of those AAMDCs, 32nd is a one-star, the 263rd is a two-star, and put them underneath SMDC. So now he's got some operational control over those forces to help, and the staff to help him with the JTF Gold and the Golden Dome for America, really the day-to-day operations and the planning. That said, a lot of those forces now are in the Middle East. So yeah. How do we reconstitute them? You know, what is going to be the give and take in terms of providing capabilities for Golden Dome for America while they're still committed over to the Middle East? And those will be some pretty significant policy decisions that will have to be made.
So, the, you know, your lay down of sort of what we have and where we are is a nice segue into bringing out Bob the Genie. Now, you've never met Bob the Genie, but as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests 3 wishes so long as they're related to the topics we've been discussing. So we can't wish for the Fountain of Youth or great wealth or any of that, just things we've been talking about. And so you've laid out a lot of interesting points and challenges and things we've got to think about. And so now that you know Bob grants you wishes and you got 3 of them, let me ask you, General Carbler, what is your first wish?
My first wish would be for a sensor that does fire control quality, long-range surveillance, nap of the air surveillance, low radar cross-section surveillance, high altitude surveillance, and again, at fire control quality data, and provides that information to any effector out on the battlefield, whether that be a short-range air defense weapon system all the way up to THAAD, SM-3, SM-3 Block 2, or even our ICBM. So how's that for the first wish?
Well, you just laid the challenge down to Bob. I mean, I saw him taking lists, and I mean, that's going to be a demanding one. I mean, that's basically like that's the unicorn of radars and fire control systems. So, you know, that's a good wish, I guess.
you didn't give me any guardrails on what Bob's capability, Bob was. And
true,
so
I don't know if Bob's
going to go work for, one of the primes or not, but so that'd be the first wish.
Okay, that's a good wish. Okay.
The second one would be a command and control system that, first off, before we even start talking about execution, a command and control system that leverages AI to do initial mission analysis. So it takes in all the threat capabilities. It takes in terrain. It takes in our defended assets. And it takes in our capabilities And this AI-enabled mission analysis then spits out the optimal, ideal mission plan that hand to commanders so that they can go put their platforms where they need to be. And over top of that is a command and control system that prevents fratricide, prevents simultaneous engagements between multiple launchers onto a target, provides combat identification, battle management, and battle damage assessment in real time, and then feeds back into the planning process so the planners can then update plans as needed.
Yeah, that's it. That's actually a great idea, because I've written a good bit about using AI and command and control systems, but I hadn't thought about it the way you just talked about it. So that's a good point. I'm going to remember that. So, okay. So great wish.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so if I could add, before I get to my third wish.
Sure.
I kind of joke that, we have our Iron Majors, you're Sam's, right? So you have some Sam's background, and I could put 100 Iron Majors in a room, and I don't, and they're great, but I don't know that as complex as Golden Dome for America is, I don't know that they could cover the entire waterfront of requirements, planning requirements that would be need to be done to fully enable and optimize Golden Dome for America.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of the requirements you just laid out are ones we don't really hear talked about. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. That was a good one. And it is complex. And you got to do it at speed, which is really the challenging part. Okay. All right. So third question or third wish.
Unlimited supply of interceptors.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. And they automatically reload themselves. So as soon as a missile goes off a launcher, Bob the genie just immediately replaces it right there on the launcher. So not quite, I joke sometimes with my compatriots, it's not quite where you have belt-fed Patriot, coming off the launchers, but an unlimited supply of interceptors that automatically get reloaded.
Yeah, that's a good wish for Bob. I mean, he can work on that. So, okay, so now, we're running out of time. So as you are about to drop the mic and walk off the stage, what's that point that you want the listeners to keep, to keep in mind 3 months or 6 months from now? What's that kind of takeaway?
So I'm going to go back to an earlier comment where in the 2000s, we made a decision to get rid of a capability within the Army, our short range air defense capability. And I want people to realize it is far easier to go ahead and just get rid of a capability, divest yourself of it, than it is then to rebuild that up. In 2000, we got rid of divisional SHORAD. Really, National Guard kept some capability. We had a little bit, but it was mostly counter rocket artillery mortar, the CRAM system. Again, to the Chief Staff of the Army, General Conville, Secretary McCarthy, and now Randy George and Dan Driscoll, they've seen the IED, or they've seen the UAS threat. Much General McConville would say it's like IEDs, but in the air. And they've put a lot of energy and resources and priority on that. But you, as quickly as you might have divested of it, you just can't snap your fingers and have it stood up and have it capable. It takes a while to rebuild a capability, not just to get industry tooled up to start producing platforms, but to assess soldiers, train soldiers, get the formations stood up, get them, facilities, get them in their locations, train them, certify them. That all takes a long time. So we need to be very careful as a department of divesting capabilities because of how long it will take to regenerate them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point. Well, General Carver, we're out of time, but thanks for coming on NucleCast. It was great to have you. It was a great discussion. I really enjoyed it. You brought up some points I'm going to have to keep in mind.
Great, Adam. Thanks so much for the time and having me on the podcast.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.